this week in Canada, there was a lot of focus on First Nations rights. There was protests that happened in a Mohawk community in Ontario on the U.S.-Canada border, where Mohawks called for the government of Canada to not arm border guards. So again, the issue of land and territory is in the news. Your work touches on a relationship between colonial histories, one here in North America, but another in Palestine. Perhaps could you put forward a couple of key points that you'll be addressing in your lecture here in Montreal at the 9th Annual Conference on Race and Anti-Colonial Studies in regards to any important links between the histories of Indigenous people here in North America and that of Palestine?
I'm going to be discussing Palestinians and Native North American nations in the context of how they might be approached and studied and interacted with in the field of Indigenous studies. The point you bring up actually about the Mohawk protest on the New York-Ontario border is an important one. Part of what is comparable about Natives and Palestinians is the fact that they don't have sovereignty over their own land, and so they are dealing with an armed presence of foreign governments. They both dealt with colonial histories that used discourses of chosenness and specialness. It was called Manifest Destiny in North America, and then the Zionist Jews conceptualized themselves as the chosen people in Palestine. So I guess the key point that I'll be addressing and that people can think about in the context of Native North Americans and Palestinians is that they have existed as victims of a comparable and, in fact, a dialectical form of settler colonization, and they're still dealing with the fallout of that colonization, and, of course, they're still resisting that colonization. And so I'm going to be looking at some ways that people can think about conjoining that resistance, you know, bringing them together, seeing what we can do as scholars and activists to assist communities in their decolonial struggles rather than just studying them from a distance.
One point you mentioned often is not addressed or talked about in the sense that you're looking at this question, which is the idea of open land. It's very much within the history of Canada's national narrative, but also within the history of Israel's national narrative. Maybe can you address more that concept, the terras nullius, or a land for without a people, for a people without a land, in the case of Israel. How critical is it to attempt to decode that type of terminology and understand what it really means in terms of the whole process of nation construction?
Yeah, that's an absolutely key point that you're bringing up. I think in the United States and Canada, some of the language and vocabulary is different, but, you know, the concepts and certainly the actions of the colonizers are more or less the same. And, I would throw Palestine in there, too. The idea of the land being empty really arises out of historical and discursive convenience. There's a sense that the Zionist settlers, the early Zionist settlers in Palestine, in the late 19th and early 20th century, sort of toted about their slogan, you know, a land without a people for a people without a land. And they were using this to drum up support, but also as a way of enticing Jews in the diaspora to settle Palestine. And in so doing, they end up, sort of running headlong into a reality, right, of a very populated space that contradicts the mythology that they're putting forward. But if you look at the early Zionist narratives of Palestine being an empty land, of it being a land of milk and honey for Jews who want to escape oppression in the diaspora, for, you know, and then the Zionist narrative of draining the swamps and taming the land and civilizing the inhabitants and doing things with the land that had once lay fallow, they're actually appropriating that discourse from the settlement of North America. That's what I mean when I say that these types of colonizations are dialectical. They're in a dialogue with one another. Ben-Gurion and other Zionist leaders of the early and mid-20th century were well aware of the types of discourses that were used in the settlement of North America by Europeans, and they constantly appropriated those discourses and applied them to, you know, to Palestine. And that's where they conceptualized the idea of an empty land. And the other main discourse here that you can see in both parts of the world is not only the discourse of the empty land, but the discourse of godly authority and godly responsibility, right? The legal system, even though it purports to be secular, right, in Canada, the United States, Israel, they actually draw a lot of their legal and philosophical rationale for settling the land on doctrines of discovery, right, in Judaic and Christian traditions.
But there is a key point of difference historically between the idea of discovery and, of course, colonization.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about land being discovered, that is very much within the Canadian national narrative. Maybe talk more about the importance. I mean, there's the specificities of history in terms of illustrating the fact that that North America was not discovered, but then there's also just attempting to decode that whole terminology.
The idea of discovery, right? You know, we look at it and we see it sort of as laughable, right? You know, the idea of discovering a place that's already inhabited, it's just Eurocentric and insulting to degrees that are difficult to comprehend, but they also have a particular legal basis, right? And that particular legal basis has been extremely important in all sorts of court rulings, for example, here in North America and also in Palestine. It's been remarkably important in terms of creating a normative identity for the settler society, right, as the proper steward of the land, and it also creates a philosophical basis for settlement. So the whole idea of discovery, as ridiculous as it is, both on its face and in terms of its attendant discourses, it has been an extremely powerful tool for the appropriation of indigenous lands. It's been remarkably effective. And Stephen T. Newcomb, in his book Pagans in the Promised Land, he shows how it's still in a wide use in North America, not only as a philosophical discourse, but as a legal rationale for the continued dispossession of indigenous peoples.
Often that parallel is not made. The one that you're making between North America and Palestine, why do you feel it's important to make it and articulate it?
For lots of reasons. First of all, because of the dialect that exists between colonial discourses in North America and Palestine, it's there. You can add other communities around the world to that. You get a comparable discourse in New Zealand. You get a comparable discourse in Australia, Algeria, South Africa, really any place where Europeans undertook permanent settler colonization. You get elements of discourse that are there. And just from a scholarly standpoint, a philosophical standpoint or an ethical standpoint, they are worth looking at. They're worth examining. They're worth, exploring, not only in terms of their similarities, but in terms of their differences as well. But when it comes to Israel and the United States, I think it's particularly important because those two countries are so aligned morally, geopolitically, and in lots of ways religiously. They talk always of a special relationship, and in fact, the United States and Israel do have a special relationship. They have a special relationship philosophically, theologically, historically, and most important, they have a special relationship politically. And one of the things that my work tries to do, and the work of a lot of other good people, is to unpack what this special relationship consists of, how it came into existence, and how really it can be undermined. I'm interested, as are a lot of people these days, in performing the type of scholarship that engages issues in the world and can identify unjust discourses and unjust politics, and then try its best to undermine those unjust discourses and politics. But with say, Israel and the United States, part of the reason that they maintain the sort of power that they maintain is by working in conjunction with one another. And I think there are lots of ways, in turn, in which communities that have been colonized and dispossessed can work with one another as well. And not only just against their immediate oppressors in the United States and Israel, but also against all kinds of unjust politics around the world, neoliberalism and corporate exploitation and these sorts of things.
We're at a very interesting crossroads in regards to the United States. There is, of course, a very strong history of social movements in the U.S., the civil rights struggle, the also struggle of the American Indian movement and the struggle for Native rights. But we've now arrived in 2009 where we have Barack Hussein Obama in the office in Washington, mm-hmm. in the White House. In terms of this history, this colonial construct of a nation in regards to the United States that you talked about, can you maybe talk about it in the context of what we are seeing today in regards to U.S. policy? Some people talk about a sea change, others don't. What's your perspective on this?
It's a great question, Stefan. I'm glad you asked it. I sort of thought that in my travels to Quebec that it would come up somewhere along the way. And so I started thinking about it, and I really want to remain non-committal without feeling like I'm just backing away from the question. I guess I want to give the man and his administration time, see what he actually does. I think that the symbolism or the symbolic importance of his election is undeniable. The type of joy that it's given people and the type of inspiration that it's given people in the United States anyway. It's palpable. It's undeniable, and it's that in itself is something worth celebrating. In terms of policy, I'm not really a believer in the ability of the state itself to change the policies in which it's entrenched. You know, the state, I guess, is engaged in neoliberal economics that are vastly unjust. It's there to serve the interests of the economic and political elite and not the interests of everyday people, not in the United States anyway, and certainly not in other parts of the world.
You talk about neoliberal economics, can you maybe just explain what you mean?
Sure. I guess I mean types of policies that open up other markets, right, in other parts of the world under the guise of the euphemism, free trade, right, that open up those markets for exploitation for Western corporations, right? So basically neoliberal policies sort of frame themselves as very progressive, but what they end up doing is sort of affecting the flow of goods and resources and money from the Southern Hemisphere into the Northern Hemisphere, from the so-called developing world into the industrial world. And so neoliberalism maintains the sort of gap, right, the ever-widening gap between those who are poor and the very small community of people in the world who are unduly wealthy. And so I see those policies in the United States as systemic, and I don't think that any one person, in a high position of office can change them. I don't think that people get into those positions of power as presidents or senators or anything else unless they have already expressed an adequate commitment to these neoliberal policies. And so I think that people should watch what Obama does, watch what his administration does, analyze those moves, analyze those policies, and challenge them. And change is going to happen from outside of the government. It's not going to happen from within the government. And that's one of the problems with the ideas of Western democracy that we're familiar with in Western Europe and Canada and the United States, is that people think that they vote, right? And once they've voted, they perform their civic responsibility, and then they can sit around and wait for, you know, the whichever politician they voted for to go out and do good in the world. But it doesn't work that way, right? When you vote, in the United States anyhow, you're giving somebody a mandate for power, but you're not forcing that person to use power responsibly simply by voting. You have to force people to use power responsibly by pressuring them, by raising your voice, by getting involved in local and national politics. And so with Obama, I think it's whether one likes him or dislikes him, I think it's remarkably naive to imagine that he's all of a sudden going to change the world for the better. That's not what the system sets up U.S. presidents to do. U.S. presidents are stewards of a particular status quo, right, that's inherently colonialist, that's inherently neoliberal, and that's inherently bad for the vast majority of the world's population. And so I don't care who's in office, whether it's Barack Obama or George Bush or anybody else. I think that we need to look at the situation realistically and challenge these policies on a systemic level rather than on the level of personality politics, which is what a lot of people want to do with Obama.
A great deal of Obama's election campaign revolved around the Middle East. There was, of course, a great deal of discussion on Obama's position in regards to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could offer a few reflections about Obama's policy in regards to the Middle East, mm-hmm. and not only the Middle East, but more generally the war that we've been seeing around the world, really, since 2001, also in regards to Asia and Afghanistan.
Right. Yeah. With the Middle East, Obama. I don't know. Obama, first of all, is just he's an unbelievably skilled and intelligent human being. He's just a brilliant orator and politician. He sensed a sea change in American attitudes towards the invasion of Iraq and the presence of U.S. troops there, and so if there was an anti-war mandate, you know, coming from the American population, he very much harnessed it and capitalized off of it. And a lot of people were pleased to see that somebody was running on what they imagined to be an anti-war platform. And concerning Iraq, his platform on Iraq, Obama's platform on Iraq, was infinitely better than John McCain's and that of the Republican Party. There's no doubt about it. But it seems like a lot of sort of mainstream liberals in the United States have become enamored of the idea of the good war in Central Asia, right, or South Asia, I guess, in that part of the world, with Afghanistan and Pakistan, and Obama is very much escalating the conflict there. He's sending more American troops over. He's rallying on world opinion for it, and a lot of civilians are being killed, and a lot of the same problems with military violence and military deployments that we saw with Bush are continuing to happen under Obama. He's also, you know, shifting a little bit in his outlook towards Iraq. So I would say that Obama has sort of presented a different vision, right, in terms of the so-called Muslim world than Bush has. It's a distinctly different vision. It's, first of all, a vision that's not influenced by godly concerns, if you will, for lack of a better phrase, right? You know, Obama's not sort of carrying forward this discourse of God's telling me to do this, God's not telling me to do that. There's not that same sense of manifest destiny with Obama, but nevertheless, a lot of the same policies that Bush applied and adhered to are still in place, and people need to keep their eye on what is actually happening on the ground and not what their politicians tell them. So even if Obama is an improvement over Bush, and I don't think any sane person would say that Obama is not an improvement over Bush. I think probably an orangutan would be an improvement over Bush, just in terms of intellect and anything else. But just because he's an improvement over Bush doesn't mean that he's producing just policies. It just means that he's an improvement over the worst president in U.S. history, and that he still needs to be held to a higher standard because people are dying. He's escalating war. He's not ending war. And I think people need to get over this idea that sending troops to Afghanistan is a good idea geostrategically, or that it's an ethical idea. It's neither strategically sound, and it's certainly not ethically or morally viable. And so I guess with Obama, there's more war happening, and until he reverses the course of that particular policy of U.S. military interventionism, then I wish people wouldn't let him off the hook.
Just a final question. Today, Obama spoke in Cairo at the University of Cairo, and I think that there is at least a perception that Obama has made a pointed effort to engage with the Middle East in a way that is different from the Bush administration. Just days after he took office, there was the interview with Al Arabiya. Of course, not Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, funded by Saudi Arabia, but an important distinction. But maybe on the heels of Obama's speech in Cairo, which is, I'm sure, today going to be receiving a lot of coverage around the world, maybe talk again about Palestine and the way that the Obama administration is approaching the issue. Again, we're hearing the repetition of the necessity of a two-state, but increasingly around the world, we're seeing a discussion on grassroots levels and also on academic circles in which you operate, the discussion of the idea of a one-state solution.
Yeah.
Maybe talk about this in the starting, of course, with Obama's speech in Cairo.
Right. I figured that the Obama speech would sort of dominate coverage over the next few days. I think it's remarkable, first of all, that a singular speech by a singular politician can draw so much interest, and that tells us just how important all of this stuff is for the world, you know, in both the East and the West. I haven't actually listened to his speech. I was getting ready to do that this morning before I travel, but, you know, there's no doubt that Obama has a presence about him. There's no doubt that he's just a gifted human being in general and an inspiring human being in general. And there's no doubt that in the Arab world, from everything that I understand, that you know, he retains a certain level of popularity. Having said that, there's only so far that one's glowing personality and oratorical skills and symbolic gestures of reaching out, such as Obama's, are going to take him. In the end, the Egyptians are still living under a horrible dictatorial regime that Obama is endorsing, even by being in Egypt, right? And the Egyptian people, of course, are aware of that. Right. Everybody in the Arab world is aware of the escalation of war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And most important, as you point out, everybody in the Arab world is aware of the fact that the Palestinians are still living under military occupation, that they're being dispossessed, that they're being slaughtered whole cloth by Israel as they did during their recent invasion in Gaza, that there's an embargo on Gaza that a lot of scholars and human rights groups have deemed genocidal, you know. So everybody in the Arab world is aware of these things, and certainly they're welcoming of Obama's presence. Certainly they're welcoming of the speech. The speech is, I should say, that he's giving there. But they're also aware of the fact that you know, there are certain fundamental policies of the United States that need to change. One of them is support for these dictatorial regimes that the populations can't stand. Another is escalation of war in the region or around the region. And then most important is the issue of Palestine and the inveterate support of the United States for Israel. These are serious issues, and Obama is only going to get by so far on the strength of his oratorical skills and his personality and his symbolic gestures before people say, look, you know, you're talking a good game, but you need to do something about these things. If you really want to improve relations, rein Israel in. All right. You know, in terms of the one state solution, it's pretty much become, in at least in my circle of scholarly and activist friends, it's pretty much become de rigueur, the one state. People find it a more ethically viable option than the old two-state model, and people also find it, I guess, more practical at this point in time. Israel's created so many so-called facts on the ground, the settlements and transferring their population into the Palestinian territories that would supposedly comprise the land base of their state in a two-state settlement. That land base doesn't even exist anymore. It's funny, if you look at it recently, a lot of Israeli politicians are actually pointing towards the two-state model as the more desirable one, right? Whereas Israeli leaders and activists for so many years were dead against the creation of any sort of Palestinian state. Now, because of the demand for a one state that's coming out of the, you know, Palestinian activists and scholars, the two state is suddenly becoming more desirable. It's being seen as a way to keep Israel's Jewish demographic superiority. Ehud Olmert, for example, came out recently and said something along the lines of, well, you know, we have to have a two-state solution, otherwise Israel's going to cease to exist as a Jewish state. So there's still a sense of demographic control based on ethnicity that's driving a lot of the sort of traditional Zionist politicians towards that two-state solution. They see the one state as a remarkably serious threat. I don't think the one-state solution, though, is really in play at an international or diplomatic level, but I have a feeling that sooner or later it's going to have to be. I mean, it's something really that can't be ignored, just in terms of the demographic, then the geopolitical realities.
Thank you so much for your time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Okay. We look forward to hearing your lecture here in Montreal on Friday night.
I look forward to being there.
Have a nice day.
You too.